The Clare Byrne Show on News Talk
with Aviva Insurance.
Well, as you may have heard in the news bulletin, preparations are underway now to bring home some Irish people who've been stranded in the Middle East by the widespread cancellation of flights there. Graham McQueen is the Dublin Airport Authority Media Relations Manager and is on the line now. So, Graham, we have some developments on this morning. There's the announcement by the government of a charter flight from Oman. Can you tell us a little bit about what's been happening in the last couple of hours?
Yeah, so we have that notification, Claire, from the government. They do intend to run that charter from Oman. That will probably come later in the week, certainly not today. Maybe tomorrow, or more likely Friday, we would imagine that would happen. And look, we're here to facilitate that at Dublin Airport if and when that happens. In the more immediate term, we've seen Emirates today announce that they're going to operate two flights between Dublin and Dubai. The first one of those is due to take off at lunchtime, just after 12 o'clock, from Dublin to Dubai. That is only going to take people whose final destination is Dubai, so not holidaymakers, it's people who are going home to that part of the world only, so probably a very small number on that flight. And they've also confirmed that they intend to run a flight from Dubai to Dublin tonight. It's due to land in Dublin about 10:15. Again, my understanding is that is likely to just carry very small numbers in the first instance, but with the hope of maybe having more flights tomorrow once those aircraft are back in position.
You don't have confirmation, though, that now we're in a situation where flights can resume to any extent?
No, absolutely not. I wouldn't want to say anything along those lines, Claire. I think this is a first step in getting people back to where they need to get to. But in terms of normal schedules resuming, you know, we're talking on a normal day, we'd operate six flights, three each way between Dubai. I wouldn't like to give any indication either way as to whether they're set to resume in the coming days.
And who makes the assessment as to the safety of the airspace, Graham, in this sort of a situation?
Yeah, look, there's a heavily regulated industry, aviation, so safety comes first. So it would be a conversation between the air traffic control people, the regulators and the airports in those regions. But safety would absolutely come first. They wouldn't be allowing these planes to take off or even think about taking off unless there was some certainty about safety.
Okay, well, that's the latest from you, Graham. Thank you very much. And we're going to be speaking to the Minister for Foreign Affairs, Helen McEntee, a little later in the programme. So we'll have more on that as we go through the morning. Now, on the war itself, we know that Israel has launched fresh strikes on Beirut this morning. Iranian drones are targeting the UAE states in the Gulf and in Iraq. And of course, markets around the world are being hit as oil and gas prices spike upwards. I'll be speaking to Stephen Erlanger, who's the chief diplomatic correspondent in Europe with the New York Times in a moment. But Channel 4 presenter Matt Fry is with us now. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning, Claire.
It's difficult to know where to start because the theatre of war is so broad, isn't it? But the Americans and the Israelis seem to have maintained their attacks on Iran in the first instance with that level of intensity we saw at the start of this at the weekend.
Well, let me start in a very specific place, which is something that's just flashed up on the wires, with the Israelis vowing that whoever takes over from Ayatollah Khamenei as a supreme leader, and we know that the council that will appoint such a person is meeting, was meeting yesterday, will meet today, whoever takes over that job will also be killed by the Israelis. And that leads me to think that there's a sort of fundamental vacuum at the heart of this war, which is you destroy the leadership, you destroy Iran's capability, but you don't really know what will replace it, and you don't really care that much either. I know that if you remember this phrase that cropped up during the first Gulf War, that Colin Powell came up with, then the Secretary of State, if you break it, you keep it. That's if you go into one of their shops in Washington or New York and you look at a lovely vase and you have it in your hands and you turn it around and you drop it, you have to pay for it.
Yeah.
That was the case with Iraq. This is not the case in Iran, right? You break it, you run away from it, or you don't care about it, or you run out of the shop without having to pay up. And I think this is a real worry for everyone, first and foremost, the people of Iran itself, who might be facing the kind of protracted chaos or even civil war that we saw after Colonel Gaddafi was deposed in Libya. It's certainly worrying for the Gulf states with their financial hubs, their service industries, their airlines, their oil and gas exports that have to go through the Straits of Hormuz. I mean, can you imagine a Libya with 90 million people in the heart of the Middle East for the foreseeable future. The only country that will not really be damaged by that is the United States, which is actually benefiting because it's self-sufficient in oil production from an increase in oil prices at the moment, having started this war.
Matt, stay with us because I want to bring Stephen in, Stephen Erlanger, who's been writing, Stephen, a really interesting piece about what Iran's strategy is in all of this. And you talk about how they are spreading the war across the region, particular focus as well on stopping shipping through the Strait of Hormuz to frustrate the American and Israeli effort. That has been their plan, one which they have had in the making for a very long time, you say.
Well, yes. I mean, in the June war, which was only 12 days and Trump bombed once, the Iranians had exercised a certain kind of strategic patience. They wanted to limit the war. This time, I think they had prepared for what for them is an existential fight, because survival is everything for them. And they have planned out a war strategy, as far as we know, that wants to globalize the war in terms of energy prices, inflation. They're very conscious that politicians need votes. The midterms are coming in America. They wanted to disrupt the Gulf, which they've done. They've taken shots at American embassies as well as bases, at hotels in Dubai. They have hit energy installations in Qatar and Saudi Arabia, though not in a terribly serious way, but Qatar stopped sending out liquefied natural gas. And the Strait of Hormuz right now is blocked, and about a fifth of the world's oil goes through there every day, normally, half of India's oil. So there are big issues, and what they're trying to do is to create enough pressure and enough disruption in the markets. The markets collapsed overnight in Asia, so Trump will see that, to encourage Trump to declare victory and go home.
Yeah, but Matt, to come back to you on that point, I mean, you have to imagine that the Americans and the Israelis factored in that this is what Iran would do.
I'd like to imagine that, but perhaps they didn't factor it in enough. I mean, I'd like to make the following comparison. Wars of choice tend to be a bad idea, you know, whether you're America or Russia. Russia launched a war of choice against Ukraine 4 years ago, and the expectation was that Ukraine would fold very quickly, and it didn't. In a war of choice, it's important that you know what you're fighting for. Now, the Ukrainians know exactly what they're fighting for, which is their survival. The Iranians, or the regime, knows what it's fighting for. As Stephen said, it's existential. It is for their survival. And they've obviously worked out quite cleverly how to disrupt the region, from markets to local allies who are not used to fighting Iran, who don't want a Shia-Sunni civil war engulfing the Middle East, etc. But America, I don't think, really does know what it's fighting for. There's been no process of consultation with America's allies. The only one that they've consulted with was Israel, and perhaps too much so. Not much consultation with their friends in the Gulf, their very good friends in the Gulf, or Saudi Arabia. None whatsoever with Britain, so once America's good friend, no longer. If you listen to Donald Trump, we're now on the enemy list and so on. So I think if America doesn't know what it's really fighting for, even though it's going to be somewhat cushioned from the consequences of all this, ultimately, that's bad news for everyone, but also bad news for the administration, because it might make them lose even more heavily in the midterm elections.
Mm-hmm. And Stephen, did you get a sense from the work that you did on the Iranian strategy, for how long can they keep this up? How long can they keep resisting, pushing back, spreading the chaos?
Well, we don't know, to be honest. Ali Larijani, who's the head of the Security Council of Iran and a very sophisticated man, says Iran has prepared for a long war. And I presume he means it, but they have a lot of missiles. They have a lot of drones. The other race going on is the race between interceptors, which are very expensive, you know, missiles that shoot down other missiles or shoot down drones. And what Iran has to shoot, I mean, some people are suggesting that Iran is holding back its most sophisticated missiles for a period when the interceptors are growing short because there's only a limited number of them. So this is a big question also. So I think, you know, what the Americans and Israelis are now trying to do is to destroy the structure of the Islamic Republic, whether it's police stations or military installations. I think they're trying to create a collapse in civil order in the hope somehow that there will be an uprising. But I think as time goes on, this is hard to know. And anyone isn't going to come out and demonstrate while the bombs are falling anyway. So, and also I think the Americans underestimate, you know, a regime that's built itself up for 47 years. I mean, it's not like it's about to crack in a second. And the big question is, with the death of Ali Khamenei, the supreme leader, what in the end emerges? It doesn't almost matter who becomes supreme leader, which may happen later today, who knows. What happens is what the elites are deciding. I mean, will they break? Will they fight each other? Will some kind of new government emerge that is more willing to talk about nuclear weapons and the nuclear program in order to end the war? But that raises the other question: why should they trust Donald Trump? Donald Trump, for three times, has betrayed negotiations with Iran. First time when he tore up the 2015 nuclear deal in 2018 in his first term, and now he's bombed Iran twice in the middle of what the Iranians thought were negotiations. Now, were they sincere? Who knows? But
yeah, I mean,
the fact of the matter is, trusting Trump is very difficult.
Well, and figuring out, Matt, what Donald Trump wants. What is this for?
Well, I think he's trying to figure it out himself. I mean, he seems to change his tune on a very regular basis. I mean, first it was about, one of the reasons was, let's help the Iranian people topple their own regime, you know, encouraging unrest on the streets. And he said that back in January when he famously said help is coming, and then help didn't come and people still demonstrated and were then mowed down in large numbers. Then it was suddenly about, you know, stopping an assassination plot against him, so killing Khamenei before Khamenei could kill him, as he put it, I think, on Saturday. It was about ballistic missiles that could threaten the United States. I mean, one reason after another. Frankly, I mean, the build-up to the Iraq war was based on misconception, some would say a lie, but at least it was consistent. And George W. Bush tried to sell that line over and over again. And then when the United Nations didn't pass the second resolution, he went ahead with it anyway. And the Brits and others and the coalition of the willing followed obediently. And the rest is history. And here we've got a president, the gunslinger in chief, the new sheriff on the block, who seems to be shooting at random. But I think what he wants more than anything else, and perhaps this is part of his performative DNA, maybe it's to deflect from other things like, you know, of inflation at home or the Epstein files. Who knows? Who knows what the motivation is? But what he likes are things that he, trophies. He loves a trophy, whether it's a golden trophy from FIFA or the Nobel Peace Prize, which I suspect might not be within his grasp this year, or indeed a head on a pike. So we had Maduro in captivity in January, and that was such a successful and relatively smooth operation, which didn't lead to regime change, but regime reboot in Venezuela, that maybe they thought, oh, we can do the same thing in Iran. You had the head of the cartel, that was the head on the pike for February, Menchen, and now you've got Khamenei in March. Who's going to be next in April? I mean, it is really quite alarming to think that even though many, many people, both in Iran and outside, cannot stand the late Ayatollah supreme leader, think the regime is evil and has massacred its own people on the streets over and over again. The fact that the process, the absolute disregard of legality has been so blatant, I think is alarming for the state of the world at the moment going forward.
Well, you mentioned his lashing out a little earlier at the British Prime Minister Keir Starmer. He also had a go at Spain, and we can hear him speaking here about Spain after it declined to allow the American forces to use the Spanish bases for strikes on Iran.
Spain has been terrible. In fact, I told Scott to cut off all dealings with Spain. Spain, first of all, it started when every European nation, at my request, paid 5%, which they should be doing. And everybody was enthusiastic about it, Germany, everybody. And Spain didn't do it. And now Spain actually said that we can't use their bases. And that's all right. We could use their base if we want. We could just fly in and use it. Nobody's going to tell us not to use it, but we don't have to. But they were unfriendly. And so I told him, we don't want to. Spain has absolutely nothing that we need other than great people. They have great people, but they don't have great leadership. And as you know, they were the only country that in NATO would not agree to go up to 5%. I don't think they wanted agreed to go up to anything. They wanted to keep it at 2%, and they don't pay the 2%. So we're going to cut off all trade with Spain. We don't want anything to do with Spain.
And here's what he had to say about the United Kingdom.
By the way, I'm not happy with the UK either. That island that you read about, the lease, okay, he made it for whatever reason, he made a lease of the island. Somebody came and took it away from him. And it's taken 3-4 days for us to work out where we can land there. It would have been much more convenient landing there as opposed to flying many extra hours. So we are very surprised. This is not Winston Churchill that we're dealing with.
It's the ultimate insult, isn't it, Matt? You know, you're not dealing with Winston Churchill.
Well, I guess he could have, you know, Keir Starmer should, you know, shoot back and say, well, we're not dealing with Franklin Delano Roosevelt either. I mean, you know, the trouble is, I mean, Americans are obsessed with Winston Churchill, even more than our Tory party is here. And, you know, every American president has had a bust of Churchill, apart from maybe Barack Obama, who had it removed, had a bust of Winston Churchill somewhere in the Oval Office at some stage. I mean, yeah, no, he is not a Winston Churchill. I think he himself would probably admit that as well, Keir Starmer. But what's so interesting about this is that whether it's on trade or on this particular war, Donald Trump, in his style, has challenged every leader of every country that used to consider itself a friend of America to consider what their values, their principles, and their interests are. And those who had hoped that they could kind of, you know, fudge along and muddle through, as the Brits had hoped for quite a long time, I think have come to a roadblock now. You have to decide. And if you're not going to decide yourself, your electorate will do it for you at the next election. And so in this country, in Britain, the Reform UK Party of Nigel Farage and Kemi Badenoch's Tories have very clearly sided with Donald Trump. They've said they should have been using those UK-US joint bases from the very beginning. We dragged our feet for 4 days as Trump has charged, and that was a very bad idea. That must never happen again. We are America's closest allies, et cetera, et cetera. But then the majority of the country is actually with Keir Starmer on this.
Yeah.
And the Labour Party, which is very rebellious, loves the fact that he's had his Love Actually moment from the movie where he stands up to the American president and reads from the Riot Act.
Matt, thank you so much. And we'll have plenty more to come on this as well. My thanks as well to Stephen Erlanger from the New York Times joining us from Berlin.
The Clare Byrne Show
with Aviva Insurance.
Weekday mornings at 9 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.